It's now November 1st, 1985, and we're at the fifth session.
To continue the story of the development of the Fitzgerald apparatus, one feature of scientific research is that's important is to maintain optimism, and once you have a history of going through a few projects that have succeeded, you feel much better about the roadblocks that you encounter in subsequent projects. I think it was Dr. Cohn, whom we have mentioned in the past, who first mentioned to me that a new research student should be given a fairly easy problem at the beginning so that he would succeed and develop his own self-confidence.
Well, that's interesting. And you've done that.
And I've tried to do that, yes. Mm-hmm. I've usually, in the past, started a new student out on a rather small problem, which he could complete in a couple of months, although in more recent years that hasn't been possible because the scope of my investigations has narrowed considerably. When I first came to Wisconsin, I wanted to develop as many aspects as polymer physical chemistry as I could, especially since there was very little going on in any other university, and so I did have quite a variety of types of work, but later these were gradually narrowed until at the end I've really had only two topics. One is viscoelastic and other mechanical properties, and that's certainly large enough in itself, and the other has been the mechanism of polymerization of fibrin and the formation of a fibrin clot, which also is a subject that's quite adequately large in scope. In fact, I've felt somewhat handicapped because this has only been a part-time activity, whereas there have been other laboratories with large staffs of technicians devoted entirely to this kind of work at other institutions. Now, I've made a few notes about odds and ends of events in the Department of Chemistry, mm-hmm. and I might turn to that, hoping that you will ask some questions if they occur to you, mm-hmm. as I proceed. When I first came here, J.H. Matthews was chairman of the department, and I think there are undoubtedly many discussions already in the files of archives about him, but I might add a few. His only obsession was with the welfare of the department. He didn't do any research. His teaching of physical chemistry was rather poor. In fact, there are stories about when K.P. Link, a character whom about whom I'm sure there are many references, when he was a student, he used to put signs on bulletin boards saying J.H. Matthews should never be allowed to teach physical chemistry. Matthews had a very low opinion of Link, I might add. The chemistry building was expanded enormously during his tenure. Well, after all, he was chairman for more than 30 years. Mm-hmm. And The story is that he had plans for expansion all drawn up so that when funds became available for something or other in the university, he could present a completely developed plan for a building, which probably gave him a considerable priority. He did, of course, have one other interest, and that was in scientific analysis of crime, and particularly cataloging of handguns, an enterprise which he carried on for nearly 15 years after he retired, with keeping his old laboratory, which was next door to the chairman's office of the Department of Chemistry in the old building. The old building, by the way, the center portion, was a course of what was a cause of great concern to Matthews and in turn to Daniels when he became chairman, because the construction was very poor. There were brick walls, not too high quality brick, I guess, and the floors were all supported on wooden beams, which were placed in sockets in the brick walls, and the beams had shrunk over the years so that they didn't protrude very far into those sockets. And the worry was that if there should be an explosion, the walls might expand a little and then all the floors would collapse. But fortunately that didn't happen. And before our new building became available. When Daniels became chairman in 1952, the need for a new building was becoming more acute, but there was a terrible dilemma. It was evident that we couldn't possibly raise enough money to make a building big enough for the whole department. We had our eye on a location on the south side of University Avenue for some time, but there was considerable resistance to expansion of the university in that direction. I think we were one of the first, if not the first, to have a large building on this side of University Avenue, but it couldn't be done all at once, and so we settled for two stages of construction. Mm-hmm. The first we occupied in 1962, and for 5 years then the department was divided, with half the people in the old building and half on the south side of University Avenue. The planning and raising of funds for this first stage of expansion took place in part in Professor Daniels, during Professor Daniels' chairmanship. But then the detailed planning and construction was during the period that I was chairman. Mm-hmm. Daniels had raised money in part from the federal government. It was one of the first buildings on campus in which a substantial amount of funding came from the federal government, I think from the National Institutes of Health, mm-hmm. and certain areas of the building were dedicated to health-related research, which was supposed to go on for at least 10 years. I don't have any detailed comments about the administrations of Matthews and Daniels, unless you have
Well, we questions. Did talk about yes. somewhat yesterday.
In 1959, Daniels was approaching retirement, and the apparently people in the department felt that I had to take it over, that there was they said there was no one else for whom there wasn't some reason for not serving in this position.
Was this because you were a peacemaker, or was that?
I felt it was simply by default. Probably there was something wrong with everybody else, though what it was, I don't know. I was very unwilling to take the position. I'd never been interested in administration. I was oblivious of politics and didn't want to have anything to do with it. But I finally did consent, and the decision was made before I went off for a leave of nearly 1 year.
Mm-hmm.
But when I came back, I took over the chairmanship, keeping the associate chairman, Professor Leslie Holt, who had been associate chairman with Professor Daniels. In Daniels, in his period, the chairmanship was re-examined every year, of course.
Mm-hmm.
This had been done in Matthew's time, and I forgot to tell an anecdote about that, which I heard from Professor Norris Hall, so I can't vouch for it personally, but apparently sometime in the 1920s, Matthews had neglected to have an annual vote with the department as to who should be nominated for chairman for the next year, and this had gone on for several years, and the department finally insisted that he had to have a vote, and apparently he was very worried that he was going to be voted out of office, but as it turned out, the vote was unanimous, or nearly so, for continuation of Matthews.
Yeah.
During Daniels' period, the votes were always unanimous for Daniels,
mm-hmm.
and at the beginning of my chairmanship, they were also unanimous. But 1 year, as we sat at lunch at the university club and department meeting, and the ballots had been handed in, and in a very informal way, I simply examined the ballots myself. I felt my face become very red, because here was a vote that wasn't for me. And this is in such a contrast to the situation in many departments, where there's a lot of dissension as to who should be chairman, and I think after that there were always a few votes for somebody else. But is something wrong with
Did Daniels work? Did he? How did the department develop under him?
Well, I would say that the principal.
Oh, I guess we did say that yesterday. You said he had appointed some good people and some not so good. Yes.
The principal development was in planning for the new building.
Yes, that's right. You said.
In those days, department meetings were conducted rather informally, and I continued the mm-hmm. same procedure.
Yeah.
We never used Robert's Rules of Order. We had none of this business of substitute motions and amendments and so
it's
on.
It's only necessary when there's real dissension.
Although in the 60s, things began to be more codified all over the university with rules written down. David Fellman spent years writing writing the laws and regulations which everyone was supposed to follow.
Did you have a plan for the department?
I didn't really have any long-range plans or strategies, and this worried me to some extent. I simply carried on a day by day, year by year basis. I did, however, raise quite a lot of money, especially for the second stage of the building expansion, and also for buying large expensive instruments for general departmental use. There had not been much of that in earlier years. Since then, millions of dollars have been spent with government funds, sometimes with matching funds from the graduate school or other sources, to buy extremely expensive installations, which now every chemistry department must have: nuclear magnetic resonance, mass spectrometry, and so forth. And indeed, this is a national problem these days of supplying enough funds for the very sophisticated equipment with which it is now necessary to carry on chemical research. I had to be involved in planning for the second stage of the building. Well, the first stage construction took place during the first years of my chairmanship, and there were many decisions to be made for that. We had a building committee, but we had to try to satisfy some of our colleagues who felt they wanted things done differently. There were a lot of arguments. And the architects were not very good. They in neither of the buildings did we have things done the way we really wanted them.
Oh, really?
And in fact, just in the past couple of years, a very large sum has been spent for renovating the ventilating system in the newer wing in particular.
Yeah, and you would have had that done if you could have then?
Yes.
It wasn't that anybody overlooked it.
We tried to persuade the architects that their system wouldn't work, but we were not successful in doing so.
Did you take this to the campus planning committee?
Well, yes. I don't remember all the details, but at one point, Edwin Larson, who was chairman of the building committee, resigned in disgust because we couldn't get the we couldn't get what we wanted.
And this was you felt just the architect, not the campus planning committee.
I don't really remember.
Yeah.
The fault in the design was with the architect and the architect.
Was he trying to save money? Was that his
I really don't remember. I'm afraid I've forgotten many of these things.
Yeah.
But one thing that impressed me was the help that was given us in the early stages of planning by Dean Kurt Wendt, who was chairman of the of whatever faculty
the campus
body,
planning committee.
Campus planning
committee. Yeah.
Yes. The first time we had to meet with the regents to go over the plans of the building, I was quite worried about what I was supposed to do, but it turned out I hardly had to do anything because Kurt Wendt took over the whole presentation to the for
well,
the
that's why I was wondering whether you could appeal to him and say, look, these architects are not doing a proper job, or whether that wasn't the sort of, wasn't done.
It, as I recall, there wasn't any mechanism for for doing that. I don't believe that the Planning Commission was concerned with such details as as that. During my chairmanship, I kept a very active research group. Fortunately, I was able to do so. My friend Bryce Crawford, whom I'd known at Stanford, was dean of the graduate school at Minnesota during this period, and we compared notes and I think agreed that we had a kind of policy of equal neglect. We divided our time between our personal activity. I kept on teaching too, but I had two phone lines, one for my research office and one for the chairman's office, and the research phone rang in the chairman's office. And if that rang, I answered it myself without going through the department secretary. But the chairman's line did not ring in my research office, so I wouldn't be bothered by administrative problems there. And I was a member of the university committee during the last couple of years of my chairmanship, and that had begun to become quite a chore. It was during Sewell's chancellorship, and things had become rather violent with lots of crises. So the university committee had to meet much more frequently than it was originally designed for. I guess their times became far worse than that later, but in 67, I resigned from the chairmanship and also from the university committee because I wanted to go on leave. I wanted to revise my book, which I had first written in 1959, also on leave, just before I became chairman, and I felt that 8 years would be enough. Indeed, since then the turnover has been much more frequent, people generally lasting only 3 or 4 years as chairman. I had decided that the only person I wanted to have as my successor was Irving Shane, and so although it may have been illegal to do so, I sounded him out first to see whether he would be willing to become chairman, and he was. So then we went through the normal procedures, and indeed he was selected for nomination, and this happened just before we moved into the second wing of the building which we now occupy. I don't believe I could ever have survived the turmoil that happened after that.
The TA
strike. Shane was able to take things much more in a much more tranquil way, I guess. Well, I'm sure it wasn't tranquil, but
they disturbed you, did they?
Extremely, yes. For example, we have a large tank of liquid nitrogen, which is essential. I don't know whether you've heard about this before.
Well, you mean during the TA strike?
Yes. It's filled every week or so from a truck of liquid nitrogen that comes from someplace in Illinois. Mm-hmm. And the TAs picketed the place and tried to prevent the tank from coming in.
Mm-hmm.
And if I'd been chairman, I would have had the police take them away. But Shane said, we won't have a confrontation. Let the truck go back to Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the members of the department were furious. They wanted Shane to resign as chairman because they had to have liquid nitrogen for their research, and
mm-hmm.
And they had to shut down some of their activities.
And when was it delivered then?
Well, I think we were out of liquid nitrogen only for a short time. I don't remember exactly how it was done. Maybe it was delivered in the middle of the night or
mm-hmm.
or something a week or so later. Then next thing that happened was that somebody shot a hole in the tank, and it drained hundreds of gallons of liquid nitrogen.
I hadn't heard about that.
Yes.
Was that dangerous or just a nuisance?
Oh, it was absolutely dangerous for the people who were there. They might have frozen their feet off, but I suppose they were careful enough not to get into the stream of liquid nitrogen. It wasn't dangerous for any potential explosion or anything, just the fact that it was a very cold liquid. No, that's as far as I have gone with respect to department history. I don't know whether there's anything else you want to ask about. Fortunately, the TA strike did not affect me personally. In the first place, very few chemistry TAs were members of the union, and and by that time, of course, I was no longer chairman, and in fact, I had a research professorship by then, which meant that usually I taught only one semester.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't have much contact with TAs, but I was the general atmosphere of the university, of course, upset me terribly.
Mm.
I forgot to fill in with one item. Could you turn it off
yes.
for a moment? There was a tradition up to Daniel's tenure as chairman that we had never lost a faculty member with a tenure appointment to another university. And of course, we were very proud of that. I'm not sure whether it is literally true, It was a tradition that no one had ever resigned from this department to go elsewhere. During the end of Daniel's chairmanship, Professor William Johnson did decide to accept an offer from Stanford to become head of the department there. He didn't actually leave until a couple of years later when I was chairman. But this was a terrible blow to many of us. I'm sure Daniels pulled out every possible stop he could to try to keep Johnson here. But it was quite alluring to Johnson because Stanford was about to build up its department, and there were resources to enable a new head to do so.
Mm.
And this was a department head, not a department chairman, so he would have a great deal of authority in his decisions, and so he decided to leave. Mm-hmm. After that, to my dismay and distress, several other people gradually went to take positions elsewhere. And this was a matter of great concern to me as chairman. And then, of course, we had to bring in replacements. Mm-hmm. And for the first time, we started bringing in senior people as full professors with established reputations, which is something that I believe had never taken place in this department before. We brought in several excellent people, but it turned out they never stayed. They moved on after a few years elsewhere. So we had a considerable turnover during my chairmanship, and it was a terribly expensive thing because to bring in an established person, it was necessary to buy a lot of new equipment, in some cases to remodel laboratories. Mm. And then after 5 years, it might all be wasted. But of course, the sums that were spent in this way were not as large as those that are spent now. Even to bring in an assistant professor now sometimes takes nearly $100,000 in research equipment, which has to be raised from the graduate school and other sources. But in those days, even more modest sums were a considerable drain and required a lot of negotiation to build up a package which would appeal. Among the people that were brought in were Jerome Burson, who went subsequently to Yale, Richard Bernstein, who went subsequently to Texas and has changed his position several times since, a man named Holm, who later went to either Harvard or MIT, and I guess there were several others, and there was also several attempts to bring in established people that failed because they didn't accept our offers. Another man came from Germany, a man named Muxfeldt, an organic chemist who had several years of brilliant work. Unfortunately, he turned out to be, he developed into being an alcoholic, but he was nevertheless hired away from us.
Which would be a relief then, I expect.
Yes, but it wasn't a serious enough situation so that we felt we were being unethical.
Yes, yeah. Must be a dilemma.
Yes. Well, that's...
Was this a question of money? Of people when they left?
When they left here.
Or was it prestige?
Not entirely. It was money and prestige and personal interests. For example, Burson, who went to Yale, had received his degree from Yale. And another man named King, who went to Colorado, felt that the pace was too intense here. He wanted to be able to spend a little time skiing also he objected enormously to the formation of the Institute of Theoretical Chemistry that Joseph Hirschfelder set up.
Oh, that's
Well, he objected because he felt it wasn't necessary.
How did the rest of you feel?
I think some of us felt that it wasn't very necessary, but Joe Hirschfelder was very anxious to have it, and so we went along with his desires. It meant a lot to him.
And was it a question of it's costing money or taking space?
Why would this man have minded? I think that some people felt that he was setting up a little fiefdom which wasn't really necessary.
Mm.
Well.
So it wasn't working relationships in the department with the TAA, nothing like that.
No,
it was a personal reasons.
In most cases, yes. Mm-hmm. I don't believe that any of these people should have been highly dissatisfied with what we were providing for them.
Mm-hmm.
But the University of Texas was able to provide a lot more for Richard Bernstein when he went down there. To give some odds and ends of comments about my working habits and research, concerning which the outline of questions that you gave me has provided some suggestions. I'll start by quoting a maxim of which my father was very fond. He had something hanging in his office which said, "Let us do quickly things for which there is no hurry, so that we may have time for things that demand haste." And this is a principle that I have followed. When there's a small piece of red tape that has to be disposed of, the best thing to do is to do it right away and get rid of it, so that you don't have to worry about it in the future. As far as planning research is concerned, I've never plotted grand strategies particularly. The direction of my research has evolved more or less naturally from one thing to another. I've always kept lists of ideas which have sometimes ripened gradually, so that I may not get to them until 5 years after they've appeared on my list, but I haven't made detailed plans such as I sometimes see in applications for funds, of which I have to review many from other people. Mm-hmm. Who often say, "This year I'm going to do so and so and so and so, and the next year everything is spelled out." I've never attempted to do that.
I just wanted to ask you, maybe it's not.
Yes.
Not
necessary. In basic research, competition with other people is sometimes a problem. And a lot of strain goes into people worrying as to whether they will get their publications out first. This has never been much of a problem for me because I've worked on things that very few people are interested in. The interest, fortunately, has developed later.
Mm.
And there have been a few times, though, when I felt that I was competing with Arthur Tobolsky, whose name I mentioned before. At Princeton, we were working along similar lines. And also in my work on fibrinogen and fibrin, a man named Harold Sharaga at Cornell was working rather intensively along the same lines in the 1950s. But fortunately, that has not been a source of concern for me. In choosing research projects, I've generally had two goals I've hoped for. One is to obtain data, fundamental data, which will be valuable even if they don't reveal new phenomena and new important generalizations, but if they, so that there will be something publishable and something for the record.
Mm-hmm.
The graduate student will certainly have a good thesis, but if it does reveal a new phenomenon or a new generalization, of course, that's so much the better. The question is asked on the outline you gave me as to whether the research direction can be changed while in progress, and that is certainly true, that the problem itself may evolve and new directions may become apparent as the results are obtained. When it comes to analyzing the results of research, although several projects can be running simultaneously with various students working on different things, when it comes to analysis, I find it's necessary to concentrate on only one subject and to devote as much intense thought and concentration as I possibly can. And sometimes I think about it in the middle of the night and get ideas as to how to resolve certain puzzling aspects.
Are you talking about a period of several hours or days?
No, I'm talking about a period of several days or maybe even 2 or 3 weeks. In getting the most out of a set of data,
mm-hmm.
I think of it in terms of extracting all the gold that's there. Thinking back to the mining days of my childhood, you can skim off the cream, to mix metaphors.
Yes.
and get something worthwhile to publish, but the data really should be mined for everything that is in there to justify the expense and effort that's gone into it.
Mm-hmm.
And I do feel that in our work we've obtained more per research dollar than in many research groups in this respect.
Is this something you do with the student who's compiled the data?
Sometimes, yes.
But to
quite an extent, it's I do it alone. But
because they're not ready yet to see what might be in everything that might be in
yes,
it.
They wouldn't see everything.
Yeah.
We would go over the data in great detail, and I always have prepared, or almost always, graphs of data myself. The central feature of data for me is the graph, plots are made of points and various curves are drawn through them. And I have probably sat down and plotted several hundred thousand points of data myself and looked at each point carefully. In this way, you mull over the data. Sometimes you plot it up in several different ways, and you become intimately familiar with the measurements that have been made. And sometimes you go back to what we call the raw data, the actual observations that were made in the laboratory, readings on dials and so on. And if there's something wrong, something seems to be strange, you go back and see if there could be anything peculiar about the original data that were taken. Nowadays, so many things are done with computers that I have grave misgivings about the development of research data in the future. People, to a large extent, even use computers to plot their graphs instead of sitting down with pencil and paper or pen and ink. They will, even data that are have just been obtained the day before, instead of sitting down with pencil and paper as I would, they punch these data into the computer and then make the computer draw a graph.
Mm-hmm.
I hate this procedure because it puts a barrier between the investigator and the data. And sometimes, depending on how the computer is being used, there are assumptions and approximations that are buried in the computer software.
Mm-hmm.
That I will give an example. Is a matter of scientific philosophy, which perhaps isn't entirely relevant to my own story. But recently, I was as consultant for the Goodrich Rubber Company. I was going over some data which someone had obtained in their laboratories. He had put his data into a computer, and the computer had plotted a graph. And there were some nice circular points which fell exactly on the curve which the computer had drawn. And I assumed that this meant that his data were agreeing exactly with the theory.
Mm-hmm.
But it turned out that the original data were not appearing on the graph at all. The computer had drawn a curve which agreed more or less with the original data that he had punched into the computer. And then the computer neatly drew several points that exactly corresponded to the curve, which were not experimental points at all. And his supervisor didn't realize that this was the case. This is just an example of how use of current use of computers can lead people astray.
It just looked too neat to you.
Yes.
So you thought this can't be.
Well, at first I supposed it was. Mm. But those were real data. But mm-hmm. but I asked some questions and uh-huh. this developed that they were not real data at all.
Do you think that they will, in the future, not use the computer right away then?
No, I don't. I think that the way things are developing, there is more and more potential for self-delusion.
Hmm. Do you discuss this with your colleagues around here?
I haven't much, no. Maybe I should write an article about it sometime.
It's interesting.
Yeah. Now, a few remarks about use of the literature. Yes, we have a little more time.
Oh, yes.
Perhaps.
Yes.
I no longer attempt to keep abreast of the literature completely. It's simply too voluminous, and I'm not at all envious of younger people who are faced with the problem of trying to absorb the literature, which in earlier days it was possible to read rather thoroughly, but I do search the literature intensively from time to time concerning a particular topic on which I'm writing a paper. Mm-hmm. And with respect to current developments, I rely quite a lot on friends and colleagues sending me copies of their manuscripts before they're published, and discussing things with them over the telephone. I think this is commonly the case in many branches of science now. The terrible mess in my office, which dates back to 1980 when I last revised my book, things got away from me at that time, is an evidence of other people's papers that I should have read and haven't got around to yet.
Is there enough on a computer so that you can do a computer search for material relevant to what you're doing?
In some cases, yes. But I rarely use this unless I'm trying to track down some very specific piece of information. Do you want to turn it off for a moment?
Yes.
I'd like to make one comment about one very advantageous feature of this university, and that is that all the sciences are rather close geographically, so that with a very short walk I can confer with someone in the medical school laboratories or the School of Agriculture or pharmacy or engineering. And in some universities this is not the case. They're far apart, sometimes even on different campuses, sometimes even in different cities. And I've enjoyed very much close collaboration with people in other departments and other schools. For example, in recent years, we've obtained materials for our research from the Laboratory of Muscle Research in the Agricultural School and the Hematology Laboratory in the Medical School. Sometimes my students have gone into other people's laboratories and spent a few days to prepare some materials, and we've had very close contact with some of the people in engineering, especially Professor Bird in chemical engineering, and Lodge in the engineering research building.
How did you make contact with these people? How did you find out who was doing things that might be?
Oh, it just developed over the years. I I can't pinpoint how it began, I'm afraid.
Because it's such a big university that I would think you might. I mean, of course, with you, if you needed, if you knew there was a muscle lab, did you say?
Yes.
And you needed material, you'd know enough to call them. But I should think there might be people working on things, and you wouldn't know it.
Well, possibly so, but in spite of the large size of the institution, just by casual remarks through the grapevine, one knows more or less what's going on.
It wouldn't be social. It wouldn't be that you'd run into somebody at a party.
No. That's really never been the case.
No, I wouldn't imagine.
Although, when I first came here, the university club was a very excellent place to become acquainted with people in other departments, and it's possible that I made contacts there of value in my research. Although mostly the contacts there were just. Nice for general intellectual stimulus.
Yes. Many people have commented upon the function of the university
club.
I'm
sure they have, and probably expressed dismay.
What do you use as a substitute? You don't go there now, I gather.
No, in later years there were so many noonday seminars and noonday committee meetings that for years I paid my dues hardly ever going there, and especially but there were no longer any dinners. I used to take my family there in the evening for dinner, and there would be dinner meetings. Well, that's all ancient history.
Mm-hmm.
I'm afraid there simply is no substitute.
Okay.
Speaking of writing up research, again, I can only write one paper at a time, and unlike many people, I prefer to begin at the beginning and write straight through to the end. I will usually have the all-important graphs drawn first, so that I know what the data are that form the backbone of the paper. But whereas some people write up the results before they write their introduction, I could never do that. I simply begin at the beginning and go right through to the end. Yeah. In connection with another aspect of writing is writing reports to the agencies that fund research. Many people grumble about that. And back when I had some contracts with the Army and had to write reports every month, that was a little too much. But I believe an annual survey of one's research for the research agency is a very good thing, because one has to organize and assess what he's done,
mm-hmm.
and otherwise there may be too much of a temptation to let things slide and avoid assessing things which may lead to reappraisal of where you should go next. I think that's about all I have to say.
What about the organization of your time when you were teaching? That is.
Yes. I never had any I never made any attempt to spend so many hours on this and so many hours on that, or to say that Tuesdays at 10 o'clock I was going to do something that I did every week at that hour. Of course, one is obliged to schedule things around classes, but other than that, I have I've organized things in an irregular manner as I've gone along.
You could write in the course of a day when you were also teaching. You didn't have to save articles for vacations.
Oh, no, I could never do that. As I was publishing probably 15 articles a year, and it was simply one article after another. But I had to have blocks of time, of course. I couldn't work on an article just for an hour or two. So I had to intersperse teaching. If I had two classes the same day, I had to do odds and ends in between those classes. And I've never been able to use a daily calendar. Sometimes I've had a daily calendar on the desk, but I don't turn over the days for weeks at a time. I have to use a calendar by the month in order to organize my appointments.
Yeah. All right.
As far as national political issues are concerned, nothing in my research has ever been involved with. In work on polymers, nothing has ever come up, as far as I know, that has had political implications. With respect to sudden and exciting advances in the field, there have been some times when there have been very interesting breakthroughs, but they're pretty much on a technical level that I don't think would interest anyone else except those.
But nothing that forced you to look again at what you were doing and reshape it.
Well, yes. For example, I had a file in my cabinet for a while entitled Tobolsky Bombshell, because Arthur Tobolsky at a meeting once came up with some experimental results which seemed absolutely contradictory to principles which I'd been following for some time, and for a few months I felt that there must be something wrong with his data, I even asked him some questions which I hope didn't offend him too much, though he was very easily offended. But it turned out that he was absolutely right, a certain quantity which I'd always assumed was proportional to molecular weight turned out to be independent of molecular weight in a certain range of variables. Another big breakthrough was the theory of Rouse, P.E. Rouse, R-O-U-S-E. His name occurs in the literature now thousands of times a year. At a scientific meeting, I think it would have been in 1952, he presented a theory which I immediately recognized as a tremendous breakthrough, and I immediately started to apply it to a lot of things, things which Rouse himself in our correspondence didn't really approve of, because he developed his theory as relevant to certain situations of a very restricted sort, solutions of infinite dilution, which and I wanted to apply it to in a much more general fashion, and I think I was perhaps the first to make extensive use of Rouse's theory, but now it's become a cornerstone of a great deal of research. Unfortunately, Rouse never did anything else in polymers. He had been working at the Franklin Institute, funded by a certain governmental source, I forget what it was, and that funding was cut off just as he reached this marvelous breakthrough, and he was frustrated and disgusted, and went into some other line of work. Well,
what are you doing research now?
Yes, I have continued. I've compressed the scope of my research a great deal in the 3.5 years since I retired. But right now I have no collaborators at all, and I really am not in a position to do experiments myself. Not having worked in the lab with my own hands for a long time.
What does happen when you lose graduate students who do that part of your work?
After retirement, you can't have any more graduate students. Mm. You can have postdoctoral associates, and I've had several in the past 3 years since retirement. I'm getting another in the spring, so that I hope to be able to resume experimental work at that time. And I have other things to do, writing and so on, in the meantime, as well as cleaning out some of my labs to make them available for other people. Emeritus professors vary a good deal in the extent to which they carry on.
Yes.
After retirement. I guess that's all I have to say. Unless you have any.
I don't think of anything now. But so, except to say thank you.
Well, it certainly has been a great pleasure to participate in this enterprise. Mm-hmm.